History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And we have a chance to make a difference because we've learned those stories don't have to go untold if we'll just take the initiative to ask a few questions and take the time to listen to the memories that start to bubble up to the surface. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price it's been paid for our freedom. And when we set out on that journey, not only do we end up educated, not only are we entertained, but ultimately we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I'd be remiss if I did not begin this episode by honoring the courageous American service members who paid the ultimate price this week in Afghanistan. Every man and woman in our armed forces today has chosen to serve our country, fully aware that they could be called upon to risk their very lives for the rest of us on any given day. The tragedy in Afghanistan is exactly that, a tragic turn of events. And we pray for the families of the fallen. We pray for the troops in harm's way today. And personally, I pray for something that these days feels like it might require divine intervention, that it might truly take a miracle. I pray for unity in our country. If you've listened to Hometown Heroes a time or two over all the years we've been privileged to share these World War II veteran stories with you, I'm sure you have heard many an aging vet note how united America was during World War II, that the solidarity on the home front and the common purpose felt by every soldier, sailor, airman, and Marine overseas was perhaps the most crucial element in the Allied victory that spared the free world from a totalitarian takeover. Unity to that degree may seem impossible in the era of divisiveness that we find ourselves entrenched in 2021. But here on Hometown Heroes, we've heard memory after memory from seemingly impossible situations that these aging veterans found themselves in all those years ago. And the fact that they've been here to tell those stories is evidence that so many of those impossible scenarios were possible after all. So yes, I do pray for unity, and I pray that the sacrifice of those brave Americans in Kabul and the more than 1 million men and women who have given their lives for this country since its founding 245 years ago will not be in vain. It's up to us to ensure that. And this program has always been a reminder to me that we can find hope and inspiration for an uncertain future by drawing on examples from the past. The day before that cowardly suicide attack at the Kabul airport killed 10 Marines, 2 soldiers, and 1 Navy corpsman, I was watching a live stream of a memorial service aboard an aircraft carrier with admirals, a big city mayor, and an NFL All-Pro paying tribute to a very special veteran. We're going to hear a little bit of that later on, but taking in that memorial service for Pearl Harbor survivor Stu Headley made me think of a couple of other incredible veterans we've lost in the last month. One, 105 years old, the other, 103. Stu was only 99. I know how grieved all three of them would have been by this week's events overseas because they lived through similar tragedies during World War II. We're going to revisit some portions of their stories today and then finish with some powerful moments from that celebration of life aboard the USS Midway Museum in San Diego. On Monday this past week came word that William Sanchez had passed away, less than a month after celebrating his 103rd birthday. Some knew him as Bill, others as Willie, but here on Hometown Heroes, we got to know him as someone who, even as a centenarian, could still articulate some of the feelings he experienced as a prisoner of war for more than 3 years. Mr. Sanchez's Army story started in 1940, and by 1941, he was headed to the Philippines.
I was a teenager. I wanted to go overseas, so it was a good opportunity for me to learn something. Things come about real fast, and you have to be ready for them.
And you were assigned to Corregidor.
Right.
Had you ever heard of that before?
No. All I heard about was The Rock. It was a little island, and there was a lot of activity all the time. But it was a good experience.
And what was it like there before December 7th, 1941?
Oh, December 7th changed everything. You're coasting right along, and all of a sudden, it's like an explosion. Things change fast.
because just a few hours after they bombed Pearl Harbor and the installations in Hawaii, they struck the Philippines.
Right. So the Philippines took quite a beating.
And I guess right before that, there had been the spotting of a Japanese fleet, so there was some suspicion?
Yes, they had spotted some up in the islands in Japan to sort of threaten our security. Times were different then, and it was difficult to accept the aggression of the Japanese. They wanted to dominate.
And you would see firsthand some of the worst examples of that.
That's right.
What was the first thing you remember about when they attacked where you were? What did you see and hear and experience?
Well, so many things happened, and so many things happened fast that you really didn't have time to think. You just acted accordingly, you know, according to the situation. I was right on Corregidor, right on the rock.
Uh-huh. And people who know some of that history know that after the Japanese attack, eventually when the Bataan Peninsula fell and there was the Death March, and they've heard about MacArthur leaving, and when MacArthur left, you were one who stayed behind.
That's right. We were left behind, not by choice, but it happened.
How did you feel about that at the time?
Not too good. The treatment wasn't very good at all.
And how about your supplies? Did you guys have the normal supplies you should have had?
No, not quite. We had to do without a lot of things, but we managed.
And as the Bataan Death March is happening across the way in April of 1942, are you guys getting updates? Are you aware of what's happening there?
We were pretty well up to date, yes. We knew what was happening at most posts. It was a difficult time for us.
How much time did you spend in the Malinta Tunnel?
Few months.
Yeah.
It was our only place we could sort of do our own thing. Those were hard days.
Yeah, as I try to imagine myself in your shoes.
Yeah.
And it seems like that's a pretty unique place to be, where you'd be pretty isolated and cut off from the rest of the world.
That's about true. Yes. You had no contact with the outside world.
And did you have a sense that at some point your capture was unavoidable?
Well, we knew it was going to happen, so we just went along with it. We had a very, very hard time. We had no say in the matter.
And after December 7th, we've got the rest of December and January and February and March and April. How often during that time were the Japanese bombing where you were and strafing Corregidor where you were?
They came repeatedly. They had no opposition whatsoever, so they came at will.
So that was just something you had to get used to?
That's it. You had to accept. You don't get used to it, but you have to accept it. It was a tough life. It was rough.
What do you remember about Cinco de Mayo in 1942?
Nothing but bad things. Everything that happened was bad.
That was the day they invaded Corregidor.
Right.
And at that point, they knew you had experience with machine guns, so they sent you out to a machine gun post?
Yes, I was at a machine gun post on the defense site. Life wasn't easy. It just, one bad thing after another would happen.
One of the reasons you've touched so many lives and inspired so many people is that you've made it through all this and you've survived all this.
That's it. I was able to endure, and I try to make things less difficult.
How did you do that?
Well, you roll with the punches and do the best you can. You accept it.
So on May 5th, after months of shelling, bombing, strafing, the Japanese are finally on your island.
That's it.
And they actually knocked out your machine gun post, right?
They did. They overwhelmed us. Their superiority was something that we couldn't endure.
But even though they hit your position, you weren't wounded and none of the men with you were?
We had some wounded, but it could have been worse.
And you went back to the tunnel?
Yes, sir. You had no freedom at all.
Well, and that was really going to be the case once the decision was made to surrender.
That's it. Actually, we didn't know what would happen at the surrender, but we found out real soon that things weren't going to be pleasant.
Well, and I want to hear about that. But before we get to that, let me ask you a question that is relevant today at age 102 and a half, because I'm sure that every once in a while you see the flag, your flag,
yes,
the Stars and Stripes. What do you think about when you see that flag?
You take a lot of pride in that.
And there was a flag, a big giant flag, flying above your post on Corregidor?
Yes.
And I understand you were asked to take that flag down so the Japanese wouldn't get it?
Yes. We tried to preserve the flag itself so that it wouldn't fall into Japanese hands. We took the flag down and we hit it.
And it had been shot up a little bit, I guess, right?
It had a few shell shots on it, yes, quite a bit.
So did someone tell you to tear it into little pieces, or was that your idea?
No, it came about. I wouldn't say it was my idea, but it was the only thing we could think of. We tore it into little pieces so that it wouldn't fall into enemy hands. Once it was in little pieces, we just kept it. They wanted the flag in toto, and they didn't have the chance to get it.
I'm just imagining, you know, obviously you're someone who signed up to defend your country, and now you're overseas in a very difficult situation defending your country, and now you're having to take apart the emblem of your country. Was that an emotional experience?
Yes, it was. But you had to accept it, and that's what we did.
Were there some tears during that process?
Yes, there was. Quite a few.
I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but I believe that I heard you mention before or read about it, that you made a statement at the time as you're completing this task that you never asked for, that the situation presented to you, about hoping no one else ever had to do that, what you were doing.
That's right. It was a very bad experience.
And I'm not trying to make you dwell in a bad experience. It's for us to understand what you went through helps us appreciate more what we have, what you and so many others paid for.
Yes. Yes, it was a very difficult time for us.
Do you remember, Mr. Sanchez, what that felt like when you heard that the general had reluctantly ordered all 11,000 troops on Corregidor, all the Filipinos and all the Americans like you, to surrender?
Well, you can't forget that. You knew you were going to lose your freedom, so it was a hard thing to accept.
Did you ever think you were going to lose your life?
Yes, all the time. At any time, you figured this might be your last moment.
And when that surrender happened, you probably had no idea what to expect from the Japanese, right?
Right. We had no idea what was going to happen to us.
What did happen to you? What was the first thing they had you do?
Most of it was bad treatment and things that you don't really expect, but you have to endure.
And you were still a very young man.
I was a very young kid, yes.
You're in your early 20s. At this point, you're 23. Do you think that some of what you'd already endured in your life prepared you to handle that?
Yes. It was a good experience to be able to handle what was coming. And you don't wish it on other people.
So now you're a prisoner.
Yes.
And you have no idea how long you're going to be a prisoner.
That's the worst part.
So how did you face that? What gave you the strength or the hope to endure, to persist, to persevere?
Well, you never lose hope. You always think something better is going to happen. And you go on that basis. Things can't get worse.
But for you, as I understand your story, after you're a prisoner, they did get worse. The Japanese gave you a real brutal task.
The Japanese were real bad. It's something we had to learn to endure.
And they made you pile up all the bodies of the Americans and Filipinos who've been killed there?
Yes. They made us take care of all the bodies and everything, and we thought it would never end.
And then what did they do with those bodies that they forced you to gather?
Oh, they just piled them up, carted them up, and set fire to it. They weren't very kind. And all in all, it was a very bad experience. But it was something that had to be endured.
And so this is 1942. And as I said, you didn't know how long, but it was going to be a long time until you tasted freedom again.
Yes. It was a very difficult time at the time.
Can you help us understand what life in captivity was like and what some of the things you had to face and endure were?
It is very difficult to try to explain what we endured. It's unbelievable, but it happened.
Is it okay if I ask you a few questions about some of it?
Yes.
And I realize that this is something you had to survive one day at a time for more than 3 years.
You never knew what was going to happen the next day. From day to day, you learn to live life.
Were there some people that you were with that helped you?
We all helped each other. There was many bad things we had to learn to endure, and we all helped each other.
You know, one thing that I think most people listening can identify with or maybe can get a frame of reference from, since we all have to eat to survive, maybe people would be interested to hear what your menu consisted of as a prisoner of war.
Leftovers. What they didn't eat, they would feed us.
Is it fair to say that you ended up eating some things you never thought you'd eat?
That is true. It was a rough time in life that you don't even like to think about.
And we talked about you being a boxer, a good enough boxer that the Bruins wanted to give you a scholarship for it.
That's right.
So you're in pretty good physical shape before this happens.
Very good shape.
Uh-huh.
But that dwindled fast.
Yeah. So how much do you think you weighed before the war?
Oh, maybe 135 pounds or something. And we were down to about 100.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very difficult life overall and the way things happened.
And, you know, people today, some of the reference points they have to this experience, maybe one of the most well-known would be your friend Louis Zamperini, and they've seen the movie Unbroken or they've read that book by Laura Hillenbrand.
Yes.
Or read Louis' book.
Louis Zamperini happened to be in my camp, so I knew real well what he wrote about.
So when he wrote about being tortured?
Yes.
You experienced similar things?
Well, life itself was a torture, and it's just something you had to learn to endure.
How often did you think about your brother or your sister or your cousins, your family back here?
Quite often. You think of what life is like to be with your family. Yes.
I've had a lot of ex-prisoners of war give me different perspectives on some of the things they did in captivity to focus their minds or to remain hopeful. Some guys would daydream about all the things they were going to eat when they got out or the business they were going to start.
You always think about that, what you're going to eat when you get out. That's the primary thought.
So what was that for you? Was there something you were really looking forward to?
No, I just learned to accept things as they were and hope for something better.
I don't ask this to be salacious or melodramatic or anything like that, but just so we understand what it was really like. What were some of the most challenging things or circumstances that your Japanese captors made you endure?
Well, first, we didn't eat enough. We were always hungry. So they knew what our limit were and everything, and things were difficult. It's hard to accept some of the things we had to endure.
And I'm sure it was different at different times in different camps, but could you give us an example of like what a daily ration might be that they gave you to eat or drink?
It would vary. Sometimes we would eat good, sometimes we wouldn't eat at all. So it would vary. It's nothing that would be steady. You just learn to accept things as they are for the moment.
And as far as the Japanese, were there some who treated you better than others?
Well, there's always one or two that are different than the others, but overall you don't get much help.
And how much of an idea did you have, or how much information did you have about what was happening outside of your prison camps?
Oh, you hear rumors and all that, but you learn that most of the things are not valid and things, and you accept them as they come. It's a hard life.
And so when you guys were surrendered to the Japanese, you were 23.
Yes.
And then you had your 24th birthday, your 25th birthday, your 26th birthday, all as a prisoner.
Yes.
When you're in prison camp and your birthday comes around, are you even aware that it's your birthday? Do you know what day it is?
Well, you accept it as it is, but it's not very pleasant, you mm-hmm. know.
And what were some of the things that the Japanese required you to do?
Whenever they could, they'd put us to work, and we would have to do labor and things that we were not accustomed of doing.
And I imagine if you're not eating much, you don't have much strength either.
Your energy level is very low, so you just do the best you can.
And how would they react if one of you was unable to do what they asked you to do?
They would do many unpleasant things that would make it difficult you to enjoy life as a whole. It's a difficult life all around. Just to survive was important. So that's what you thought of the most. How am I going to survive all this?
Well, and I guess that's the biggest question. As we look to your example and we marvel at the fact that you're still here and still able to tell this story, the biggest question is, how did you survive? How'd you do it?
It's a mind over matter thing. You have to think positive that eventually it's going to end.
Were there ever days where you woke up and felt, I don't know if I can do this anymore?
Many, many a day. How much longer do I have to do this?
And again, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. I'm just wanting to understand how you really felt and what your experience was really like. But a situation like that, those circumstances that no one would ever choose, how does that affect your view of God or your feeling as to whether it's worthwhile to pray or if anyone's ever going to help you? Is that something that was relevant for you?
Sometimes you wonder if there's any help. It's very difficult to go through the things you have to endure because where do they come up with these ideas? It's not an easy life.
And I don't want to leave anything out that would be important to you, but one thing I'm sure that a lot of people be interested in and hopefully is a little more pleasant memory for you. And I know there's a lot of things that happened over the time from the time you became a prisoner to when you were liberated. But help me understand what it was like when you guys started to realize, hey, the end is near and we may get to taste freedom again.
It's a very, very good feeling to think that you're going to have freedom again. Just the thought of it makes it exceptional. You always think the best is going to happen. You never think of the worst. It's always the best.
Where were you, and can you help me understand what it was like when that taste of freedom finally showed up again?
Oh, exhilarating. I was a prisoner in a prison camp when they finally decided to surrender. And boy, that was a great day. It was a great feeling just to be free. It was just something you experience once in a lifetime, freedom. You realize what the word freedom really means.
That was William Sanchez, who passed away this past week at the age of 103. UCLA, which had once offered him a boxing scholarship, had hoped to honor Mr. Sanchez at a football game next month. When we come back, a one-time UCLA football player who just passed away at 105. He, too, was in the service before Pearl Harbor. He, too, had quite a story to tell and an incredible legacy to leave. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you're a business owner, I've got a phone number you really ought to take down, 800-989-1139. And when I say business owner, I mean businesses of all shapes and sizes, from the multinational chain to the hot dog stand on the corner, or my personal preference, the taco truck, 800-989-1139. Because you can have the greatest product or service in the world, the best business plan, the most capable workforce, and still not maximize your potential if you don't have a reliable, efficient, and versatile plan for processing payments. 800-989-1139. That's the number for my friends at Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in the country. Why is Provident growing so fast? Because they're committed to helping your business grow. 800-989-1139. That nonprofit you love that relies on donations? Provident can even connect you to a special software platform to streamline and stimulate giving. If you are ready to grow, give it a go. Go Provident today at providentpayments.com or call that number, 800-989-1139.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode this week honoring three amazing veterans who spent a combined 307 years on this planet, but whose lives easily could have been cut short during World War II. When it comes to the 13 American lives tragically lost this week in Afghanistan, we will never know what those 10 Marines, 2 soldiers, and 1 Navy corpsman might have done with the rest of their lives. But in William Sanchez, whose memories you just heard, in Stu Headley, whose memorial service on the USS Midway this week brought glowing tributes, and in Jack Perrin, who we're going to focus on in a moment, there are three powerful examples of the kind of difference, the kind of impact, the kind of legacy those who do survive can pass on to the rest of us. All three of them dealt with devastating loss during the war. Jack Perrin was laid to rest in Southern California earlier this month, not too long after celebrating his 105th birthday. Jack had competed in football and track and field at UCLA, rubbing shoulders with stars like Jackie Robinson and Kenny Washington. And while his young bride, Lorraine, contributed to the war effort by working at the Douglas Aircraft Factory in Santa Monica, Jack was sent by the Navy to Pearl Harbor, where he would ultimately engage in secret work that would yield some very significant public results.
And on the ship, they had me reading the code. We'd get messages from other people, and I would help them to decipher them and put them in English. Because of that, I think they put me in the Naval Intelligence. They sent me to Hawaii, and we started off, three actually, ended up doing it, going around checking on people and bad guys and good guys in Hawaii. At this point, we went to work at the Halekulani Hotel, which was owned by a big Navy officer. But that didn't last very long. At 10 days of heaven, going to the four shows and everything else in Hawaii. But after about a week, they called us in. Said, well, you three guys are going down someplace else. Pack your bags and get in the station wagon. And we did and went down to the submarine base. And we were both, all three, went in to be inspected. And it was in a secret passageway, kind of, in the basement. We went back down there, and it was a kind of a dungeon place with a special guard and all that, and it turned out to be a very secret place. It was where they were reading the Japanese code, so it was obviously a very secretive place, and we sneak down there. We go down the basic tunnel, another drop down, and you go in the basement of another building that was there. There was a senior officer in charge. He had a couple other officers around, but there wasn't too many people. And there were about a half a dozen men breaking codes.
Let me bring you right back there in a minute, but I do have another question. Because you're arriving there in Hawaii about 6 months after the Japanese arrived in that surprise attack.
We were there in April.
So I'm guessing that you could still see evidence of what had happened in December. What were some of the things you saw, and was it jarring to you? Could you see the Oklahoma, the Arizona?
Oh, yeah, you could see all that. I didn't go out. I didn't go on a boat and look at them, but I could see something sticking up. And I knew, I was aware, of course, that they've been sunk with a lot of men. And then I had another one, but most of the men got off, and they were the band of one of the battleships, and the band got off.
I'm just curious, because here you are. If I do the math, you're 25 years old. This war has started, and now you're at the place where it began, and you're seeing something that I imagine might be a little sobering. When you see a battleship upside down or sunk and you know how many lives were lost, can you help us understand what kind of emotions maybe that produced in you?
I can't recognize that I had emotions. I think maybe I've been getting used to things that didn't bother me.
And you mentioned the band. So you're talking about the USS Maryland, which is another battleship that was damaged at Pearl Harbor, and yeah. Some of the bandsmen actually ended up working in that code room with you?
Absolutely. They worked with the translators. There were about five translators, about three of them working all the time, reading the Japanese code. There's a certain technique in reading codes and breaking them down, and they were very good at it. And they absorbed both of the music guys that had been on the battleship Maryland, and so most of the band went with our unit, but it was divorced from our unit, but it was part of our unit, you know what I mean?
And this was Hypo?
Yeah. Well, Roford was the commanding officer of the unit, and he was a Mustang, which means he did not go to the academy. The regular Navy people in Washington criticized him, but they wanted to have the glory of some of the success we had.
Well, and I want to talk about some of that success you had, but first maybe you can just help us understand. So this is in the basement of the administration building at Pearl Harbor.
In the basement.
And this is secret work that you guys are doing. So how far did you carry that secrecy? Were you allowed to tell any of your friends that this is what you were doing, or tell your wife that this is what you were doing?
Oh, God, no.
No.
Very, very secretive.
Uh-huh.
This is breaking the Japanese code. We broke their code, and they didn't know we had done it. We could read the Japanese stuff, and they couldn't read ours, theoretically. I think they probably did read some of ours, anyway.
I'm curious about the secrecy element. I'm sure you and your wife are writing letters back and forth. What did she think you were doing out there?
Well, every letter she got had things cut out. She didn't know anything about doing.
The censors took some scissors to it?
All my mail was censored, and it was cut out or erased or something.
You know, so many of the vets that I've interviewed were in a plane, you know, flying against the enemy, on a ship in battle with the enemy, in a foxhole watching artillery come in. Here you are in a basement at Pearl Harbor. Did you have a sense of the gravity or importance of your work, and that maybe even lives depended on whether or not you did your work well?
Oh, we understood about the work pretty well, because, I mean, it was so secret and it was so important, because we were reading the code. Let's say it says a 15-20 ship convoy of Japanese coming from down south somewhere, and they're coming up to hugging the coast for safety, and they're coming right back up to Tokyo. We'd get some of those kind of things. So we could sit our submarines out. Maybe that'd be my watch. Let's say it's midnight, and I'm the only one on watch. If a message comes through, I'd have to send the message out to our submarine.
So when you say a message comes in, is that a message coming in plain English, or is that encoded?
Well, it could be encoded. Let's see, a message comes in Kan alphabet. And the Kan alphabet is, of course, the Japanese alphabet. Mm-hmm. But then we've broken the code so we can read it. Some of them. We have four or five translators that are working on that. And these translators are people, including our commanding officer in my unit. They lived in Japan to learn the customs and to do it. I was very impressed by that. The fact that they had arranged ahead of time to watch out for it.
That there are people that have been living in Japan before the war who then could put that knowledge to use.
The Navy places men in key positions where they can learn things that will help them at the time of war. That's what came through to me, and it was very good. These were men like Mike Skipper, Roquefort. He was able to communicate in Japanese because he studied Japanese over there. So anyway, Roquefort was a very, very capable man, and he was a wonderful skipper, believe me.
So I know one of your passions has been fishing, and you even established a fly fishing academy at Silver Lake, one of your favorite spots in the Eastern Sierra. But
yeah.
It, as I understand it, from way back in 1942, you guys threw out a little bait for the Japanese. Whose idea was it to send a plain language message and see if you could get the Japanese to confirm the location of their planned attack?
That was actually, I heard them let you go. Jasper Holmes was the executive officer for our officer in charge, which was Roquefort.
And so they said that they could fake some kind of problem on Midway? The message said something about the water desalination plant failing or something?
Yeah. Roquefort sent a plain language communication that the water was Midway was no good anymore or something. The thing broke down that supplied the water.
So, I mean, this was a real creative plan to kind of sucker the Japanese into confirming that Midway was indeed the target, because otherwise the brass was going to focus the attention on one of those other spots, right?
Well, they wanted the brass wanted to go down south. Well, that was foolhardy.
And so somewhere in the codes that you had intercepted, the Japanese had been talking about a target that they referred to as AF?
AF.
So then once you kind of put out the bait about Midway having a water plant problem, then you intercept the Japanese broadcasting about AF?
Yeah, well, yeah, that, they just talk about a water problem, but it didn't have it. They just talked about it.
Yeah, but I understand that even after that, so basically the Japanese have confirmed in your minds there at Hypo that Midway is the target, but Roquefort still had a hard time convincing Washington that that was the case.
Well, I don't think he had too hard a time because he would feed it to Nimitz, and Nimitz would carry the ball.
So first the question is, well, where is this battle going to take place? Where are the Japanese going to concentrate their forces? And then you guys are still there at Pearl Harbor as the Battle of Midway unfolds, which we know now is a huge turning point in the war. What was it like for you as you found out, you know, you kind of got a play-by-play, as it were, about what was happening at Midway?
Everything we did, I thought we were on the upper hand.
Was there any kind of reaction, celebration among your fellow Hypo personnel when you all got word of what really turned into a great American victory at Midway?
Well, everybody's very happy, but in wartime, you don't get very happy about it, anything, really. It's part of the job, and you get it done, and you're pleased about it.
You know, there's so many facets to a giant battle like Midway, and we've heard from a lot of people over the years on this program who were there, whether they're on one of the carriers or, you know, they're in a dive bomber diving on these Japanese carriers.
Yeah.
One of the other stories that has become very famous is the story of Torpedo Squadron 8 and the fact that only one of the pilots from that squadron survived, Ensign George Gay. And I think I heard that you were actually at your station when a message came in that they had recovered Ensign Gay?
Yeah, they found him. He was floating around the ocean.
So we move on from Midway, and just a few months later, a couple months later, you have the Battle of Guadalcanal. And I wanted to ask you about this. You said a very good friend of yours was killed aboard the USS San Francisco.
That was Witter, Gene Witter.
How did you know him?
Well, he's a fraternity brother. He's a fraternity Zeta. I'm a Zeta, and his fraternity is in Cal, and mine's in UCLA. But we got to know each other, and he was there on the USS San Francisco. It all beat up the Guadalcanal. He was a very nice guy.
Well, let's talk about Admiral Yamamoto.
Oh, yeah.
You've given a few talks about your war experience, and I'm sure people have asked you, who was Admiral Yamamoto, and what did you guys have to do with him?
Yamamoto was the head of the whole Japanese Navy. He spent a lot of time in the United States. He got shot down because we broke the code that he was coming on the inspection tour. This is after Guadalcanal. He was a...
Well, maybe we approach it this way. So the code-breaking work that you're doing continues long after Midway. And Midway, you trick the Japanese into giving away the location of their attack. So instead of them surprising the Americans kind of surprised the Japanese. But you're continuing to work on this Japanese code to decipher it. And it gets to the point where you guys have a pretty good handle on it, and you're able to intercept a message that's saying exactly where Yamamoto is going to be. And you actually have that message, right?
Correct. We had the message. We knew he was going to be flying, making a survey of the different stops where they had outposts. They broke that down, the fact where it was and so forth, and that made it very easy for us. Not easy, but advantageous.
I'm going to try to read this here because I have a picture of it because you've held on to this. It says, on 18 April, Combined Fleet will visit in accordance to the following schedule. And it says, you know, depart at 0600 in a medium attack plane escorted by 6 fighters. And it goes on and on. And I'll put a picture of this online at hometownheroesradio.com. But you guys have a clear, perfect picture of where the architect of the Pearl Harbor attack is going to be flying.
Correct.
How did you guys obtain that? How did you figure that out?
Because he put out his itinerary. He was going to make a stop at different spots where they have outposts. he would stop and say hello and go on the next one, inspection tour. So he was vulnerable to something being read.
So because your office was able to intercept that message, you pass it along, and ultimately the Army Air Corps sends 16 P-38s up after him and took care of business, huh?
Correct.
Yeah, so as I understand it, this is something that Admiral Nimitz and Admiral Halsey discussed, whether they should go ahead and take Yamamoto out, and they decided to do it. So then those P-38s go after him, and there's actually a pilot by the name of Rex Barber who shot him down. I guess what I'm curious for you is, as someone who is there at HYPO, working in the basement all this time while the war is going on all over the world, getting the news of that, was there some significance to that when you find out, hey, they were able to take out Yamamoto because of what we learned?
It would feed the intelligence of them. I was down in the dungeon. Down in the basement of the building.
Did that work ever get monotonous when you're looking at numbers and letters and blocks of letters day and night?
No, because each one was different. It was exciting, really. It was exciting, and you knew you were doing something very constructive, and you were defending your commanding officer because you thought he was doing such a great job. Breaking the code was so helpful to them. The Japs had no idea we were breaking their code. They thought it was so confusing to us that they don't worry about it. That was the impression I got.
And, you know, we hit on a couple of the big ones. The fact that, you know, the tide was turned at Midway because of work that had been done in that dungeon there, and that Yamamoto was shot down. And in that case, you're the one who actually sent the message yourself, right?
Yeah.
So
whoever's on watch would send it.
So you had the privilege of taking that information and sending it out to the people that eventually would go after Yamamoto's plane and shoot it down.
Well, they were directed to it because of the intelligence that they used.
But on top of that, in Midway, there are a lot of other, you know, less famous situations where you guys would get messages about a Japanese convoy, and then the submarines could go and attack those convoys?
What happens would be certain hours at night that the submarines would come surface, and we'd wait for them. When they did it, we would broadcast to them and tell them what's happening, and the convoy is coming up from Malaysia or whoever it is, hugging the shore, a convoy of how many ships. And then our submarines could go and sit and wait for them. We had a field day with the submarines. Really great.
After leaving the Navy, Jack Perrin followed his stepfather as the president of Towel Saver Incorporated, which revolutionized the hand towel dispenser industry. Jack's autobiography, On a Roll, details much of that journey. But in his last decade of life, his pride and joy was the fly fishing academy he established for young people at Silver Lake in California's Sierra Nevada.
I started this program with the young kids, getting them involved and teaching them how to fly fish and all that. Once a year, the fellow that runs the camp there sets it up. We do a great job. We take all the young kids around 15, 16 years old. Like to get them around that age, 14 to 15, better. And we teach them how to fly fish. We have a couple of instructors. Other people come and watch and help, and they'll. We bring 18, I think, in. We have the guides. And the guides take them out fishing, and we supply the shoes, wading pants, and a helmet, and glasses for sure. We won't fish with them without glasses because it might get them in their eye. I know people get flies in their eye once in a while. So we watch it pretty carefully. It's my baby. I started it, and I just love it.
He loved it till his dying day at age 105, and that Silver Lake Fly Fishing Academy is one piece of Jack Perrin's legacy that will certainly carry on. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, some of the more memorable tributes at a very special memorial service this week in San Diego for Pearl Harbor survivor Stu Headley. You've heard Stu share his story here on Hometown Heroes, but you're going to hear what some who knew him best had to say about him this week when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's
one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and I promised we would hear some of the tributes to Stu Headley from an unforgettable memorial service aboard the USS Midway Museum in San Diego this week. The Midway produced an outstanding live stream of the event, which is on YouTube and Facebook, and I have it linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com if you'd like to watch the entire thing. Bagpipes, taps, of course, a flyover featuring vintage warbirds, all part of a tribute to a Pearl Harbor survivor who never tired of telling his story because he really felt the past held some valuable lessons that could impact our future. Last year, I had the privilege of hosting a television special with Stu and his fellow Pearl Harbor survivor, Mickey Ganich. Mickey was sitting in the front row aboard the Midway at age 101 this past Wednesday to honor his late friend. Pearl Harbor survivor Bob Fernandez was also there, but it was moving to hear some of the younger Americans share their perspective on Stu's legacy and his impact, and that includes the 43-year-old mayor of San Diego, Todd Gloria.
I wish I were here speaking with you under better circumstances. But I think the fact of the matter is that this is not a memorial service. This is a celebration of life for someone who lived an absolutely incredible life. Stu lived every single day of his 99 years to the absolute fullest. And to Stu's family, his five children, in particular Nancy, good to see you, and his five grandchildren and his nine great-grandchildren, I want you to know that our entire city is thinking of you. We're grieving with you because you're father, your grandfather, and your great-grandfather was a treasured member of our community, someone who so many folks whose lives were touched because of him and his service. Many of us have got those hugs that were so special. You know, I'm here today. I'm often asked to speak on as mayor of the city of San Diego. That's my job, right? But I'm here as a friend of Stu's. I met Stu 20-plus years ago as a baby congressional aide to U.S. Congresswoman Susan Davis. We spent a lot of Saturday mornings in the basement of the Veterans Memorial Center together. The greats of our community, people like Pete Hubin and John Smith, Alan Darcy Pavage, wonderful people who at the beginning of my career helped me understand what public service was about. And listening to Stu tell those stories, and yes, they were not short, that's right. But I savored every word that he would share, understanding the privilege that it was to hear from a great American, a great San Diegan, about what they contributed and what they continued to contribute to our community. You know, I had the opportunity to last see Stu at the Mount Soledad National Veterans Memorial Service on Memorial Day of this year. As I arrived at that event, which despite the circumstances were still extremely well attended, Stu was there in his iconic white Pearl Harbor Survivor jacket, decorated with all the patches and awards and medals. I noticed that Stu had slowed down a little bit. Understandable. But I will tell you something. He saw me, and he insisted on getting up to have a conversation, to give me a hug. I tell you, that was a pretty darn good day. As I sat on the dais that day, also asked to say a few words, I watched Stu in the front row. As with many things, this was not Stu's fault. This was not a brief ceremony, everybody. This was 2+ hours, extremely warm day, the top of the highest hill in our city. Hot, steamy, long. Stu was there the entire service, never breaking a sweat. I think that's remarkable. And I think that that's really indicative of who and what Stu was. He's someone who understood that his service to this community and to this country was never done. He would always pay it forward, whether it was going to classrooms to share important stories about Pearl Harbor, or whether it was being present on that day where we honor our nation's war dead. Stu continued to show up time and again and really showed what is now understood very clearly by all of us as being the greatest generation. And I want to say to those of you who are members of the greatest generation, I continue to stand in awe of what you've contributed to this great country. I'm in awe of the fact that not only did you save this country and the ideas of freedom and democracy against a terrible enemy, but you came back and continued to serve your community just as Stu did. As Admiral mentioned, it wasn't just his valiant service on December 7, 1941 that made Stu's life meaningful. It was the fact that when he came home, he went on to serve his community as president of the Pearl Harbor Survivor Association, and he did work day in and day out that again touched the lives of so very many people. He continued on as a public educator, a profession that I have tremendous respect for, touching the lives of students in classrooms throughout this community for a very long time. Put simply, Stu's life helped to make San Diego a better community for all of us. I cherished every opportunity I had with Stu. In that basement at the Veterans Memorial Center, atop Mount Soledad, wherever it was, getting one of those wonderful hugs, hearing the great stories, really trying to absorb what it is to have a life that was well lived. I will miss our conversations. I will miss those hugs. I will miss that energy, that positivity. He was truly a special human being. So on behalf of a grateful city, please know that we are grateful for his commitment, for his contributions, contributions that will surely last on for generations more to come. And I will say just in conclusion, Stu spent his life making sure that we never forgot the tragedy that was December 7th. And in this day and time when it seems like facts seem to be irrelevant and people can't see what is before their very eyes, let's honor Stu by making sure that that history, those lessons are never ever lost. That's how we can best honor Stu. And let's do a little bit more to live a more like Stu. Because he never said a bad thing, never in all the conversations. He was always quick with a hug. He would always find a way to make your day brighter. We could all use a little more Stu Headley in this city and in this country. Continue to tell the truths, to make sure that people never forget, and leave the world a little bit better than you found it. And that's what Stu Headley did. And I say to Stu, Godspeed, my friend. I know that you are sitting with Wanda looking down upon us today with great pride for this beautiful community that you've left better than you found it. I'm grateful to him. Godspeed, my friend. God bless you all. God bless America.
That was San Diego Mayor Todd Gloria memorializing Pearl Harbor survivor Stu Headley. There were two Navy admirals who spoke as well, a high school student whose perspective was shaped by Stu's passion, and here's Holly Schaffner, a retired Navy lieutenant commander who got to know Stu through Honor Flight San Diego.
We had the pleasure to take Stu on his honor flight in 2011. And he was one of the first veterans from San Diego County to go on his honor flight. Dave Smith tells the story that when they returned from the 3-day trip, Stu said, "Let me know how I can help you with the honor flight." And so it began. Stu traveled with Dave all over the county to help him introduce Honor Flight San Diego to the community and help raise funding to take future honor flights. Most importantly, Stu helped Dave find fellow World War II veterans to go on their honor flight. He must have done a pretty good job because with Stu's help, we've been able to fly over 1,400 local veterans on their honor flight. Stu did so much more than helping with outreach. Because of his faith, he was always our go-to chaplain to deliver an invocation at our events. Stu was always the first to share his World War II stories in hopes that children would listen and learn the history that they couldn't find in books. When I asked the Honor Flight family if they had anything they wanted me to share about Stu, Captain Steve Shepard told me, Stu shared his World War II story with hundreds of thousands of people. And now we have the great responsibility to continue to share his story and the stories of World War II so that our heroes will never be forgotten. When Stu's 99th birthday was approaching last year, we asked him if we could do a drive-by birthday party for him. He had no idea what that meant, but in true Stu fashion, he shared his special day with his good friend and fellow Pearl Harbor survivor. They sat for hours waving to hundreds of people who came from all over San Diego to wish him a happy birthday. That is the effect Stu had on people. He was excited about celebrating his upcoming 100th birthday this October, and Honor Flight was on board to help him with that. On a personal note, I was blessed the last 18 months to spend a lot of time with Stu. During the pandemic, I called him every few days, I made and delivered meals to him, and he came to my house to Zoom with children's classes from all over the United States. My favorite days were the days we had putting contests in his backyard on his putting green. And yes, I will admit it, that 9 times out of 10, this 99-year-old man legitimately beat me. A fun fact about Stu is that in his prime, he held a single-digit handicap, something most of us golfers strive for all of our lives. All of us with Honor Flight San Diego will remember Stu for his tireless energy, infectious smile, and the best hugs anyone could ask for. We are blessed to know Stu not only as a World War II veteran, but as our friend. This is a celebration of life, and by seeing all the people here today and all those watching online from all over the United States, it truly shows what a full life he led and the lives he touched. Our condolences to the Headley family for your loss. May Stu rest in peace and know that we will continue to share his legacy. God bless you, Stu.
That was Holly Schaffner from Honor Flight San Diego. Again, these are excerpts from a close to 90-minute celebration of life this week aboard the USS Midway in San Diego for Stu Headley, a spirited Pearl Harbor survivor who passed away this month at the age of 99. Donnie Edwards, founder of the Best Defense Foundation and a former all-pro linebacker in the NFL, shared a heartfelt tribute as well.
I know about those putting contests in the backyard. I beat an NFL football player. Well, good morning, everyone. My name is Donnie Edwards. I'm a San Diego native, the grandson of a Pearl Harbor survivor, a former San Diego Charger, and a very good friend of Stu Headley. I'm here to talk about my friend Stu and share with you what I know to be one of the most genuine people I've ever met. Anyone that knew Stu knew of his faith. He put God before everything, and his dedication to everything he believed in was powered by that faith in God. I met Stu several years ago through a mutual friend, and we hit it off immediately. We had something in common. My grandfather, Maximino, who was like a father figure to me, was a Pearl Harbor survivor, and my affinity for World War II history was something that I could talk about and listen to endlessly. You can say that Stu and I were meant to be friends. We talked as if we'd known each other for decades, and we made time to get together often. Whether it was for a meal or one of our Best Defense Foundation programs, I was sure to always, as you know, get on that busy calendar. Every time Stu started talking about something, everyone would listen. He had that persona. You always felt like he was going to drop some wisdom on you. Wisdom that a man of his years has. Because he lived so long and have seen so much. He could talk to everyone. Young and old, no matter the background or age. Stu had words of wisdom. His advice was simple, strong and direct, but simple. When Stu would say, stay in school, get good grades, strive for excellence. I know you guys hear that. They carried some weight. He made a point to reach out to kids and wanted to communicate with them and to let them know that they had the ability to succeed in life no matter the circumstance. He wanted to motivate them to see them through a wider lens. When we went on our programs or had dinner with a group of people, Stu was always the one who spoke up and shared his thoughts. We all felt blessed to listen and to be enlightened. I can't help thinking as we go through these trying times in our country right now, what Stu would say. I think we all know. Keep America alert. As we navigate our lives with the void he has left, I feel that his spirit will remain with us. Stu may not have been born in San Diego, but he was a true San Diegan through and through. Everyone knew the Pearl Harbor veteran in the Hawaiian shirt with the white pants and the white jacket. His words of wisdom will echo through our heads, and we'll see his smiling face every time we pass by the USS Midway and his blessings and prayers he's bestowed on us before we hung up the phone or walk away will last a lifetime. I will miss my old buddy more than I can say. I spent a lot of time with World War II veterans and have to say goodbye to more than my heart can handle at times. But Stu Haley was different. He just had something about him. I'm going to leave you with a quote from Stu that he shared with the students at Eastlake High School before the pandemic. Here's what he said. Young people, strive to do your very best. Don't be mediocre. Stand out. Set yourself a goal and stick with it. But aim high. You are the future of our country. We are passing on and we are leaving our legacy to you young people. Remember Pearl Harbor and keep America alert. Thank you.
Again, thanks to the USS Midway Museum, you can access that entire memorial service online. I have it linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, where you can also access the programs we've done with Stu here. He was an exemplary American in so many ways, and when he repeated that motto of the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association, he never did it lightly. Stu Headley's memorial service came one day before the tragic attack on U.S. forces in Kabul, and the death of those 13 American heroes in Afghanistan adds context and adds gravity to those words, which we're going to hear one more time in Stu Headley's memorable voice.
Remember Pearl Harbor. Keep America alert. America is asleep. It has been ever since the beginning of World War II.
The destruction at Pearl Harbor and more than 2,400 American lives lost there awakened that famous sleeping giant and fueled a resolve and unity of purpose in America that eventually propelled Allied victory in World War II. 80 years later now, the tragedy at the Kabul airport is a nightmare that historians will someday dissect, I'm sure. But what does it mean for us and how we approach our future? What if each one of us takes a little time this weekend to ponder that with perspective applied from the three amazing men we honored in this episode, William Sanchez, Jack Perrin, and Stu Headley. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, encouraging you not to take anything for granted and to remember that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.